Hello and welcome to Unofficial Partner, the Sports Business Podcast. I'm Richard Gillis. Today we're talking to Tim Hollingsworth, OBE, the Sport England Chief Executive and former CEO of the British Paralympic Association. Tim leads Sport England's mission to get us all moving by investing government money in sport and physical activity. This gives him a perspective into some really important questions, such as what's the role of government in sport? What does it want sport to do? Does the system of national governing bodies work as well as it should? Are they able to respond to a fast-changing culture in which it's easier to order a pizza than book a tennis court? To find out more about Sport England's work, I'd point you to their recently published 10-year strategy document called Uniting the Movement, which we reference during the conversation. If you like the podcast, you'll love the Unofficial Partner newsletter that goes out direct to the inbox of thousands of senior executives across the global sports business every Thursday. To join them, sign up via unofficialpartner.com. Here is Tim Hollingsworth. Thanks very much for coming on. Fulham fan, I noticed.
Yes.
Is that family or is it location or is it a moment in time?
Oh, God, I've got to have to admit this now. It's a bit of a look. It's more than 30 years now, but it wasn't my childhood. In fact, my first memory of a cup final was 1974 and Keegan scoring against Newcastle. And I decided there and then that I liked Liverpool, which, given I grew up in Southeast London, I probably the club closest to me was Crystal Palace, actually, and sometimes regret that a non-football loving parent wasn't on hand to take me there, and it might have given me the sort of childhood sort of connection. If I'd just waited 1 year and maybe sympathised with Fulham losing their one and only cup final in 75, that might have made all the difference. But anyway, I grew out of my childhood love of Liverpool around about the time that Graham Souness was the manager and realised that I didn't have any connection to the club at all. And I played around with just, and then I went to university and I came back from university and I met a guy that I started hanging out with in London as a friend who was part of a group of people who had lifelong season ticket holders from school at Craven Cottage back in the days before all the stadium redevelopment, where you could just go along and stand around wherever you liked in the lower divisions. And I just started going with them. And before I knew it, I was going away. And so this was in the late 80s, early 90s. So I've been a fan since then. So I've got some cred and that I've been to quite a lot of grounds with Fulham over the years, particularly as we went up through the divisions. I've been to a European final with them, but they weren't my childhood club. And I feel quite embarrassed saying that because I know you're supposed to stick with something.
I thought you were going to say that it was the 1975 cup final, that because around about that time, Fulham, there was a sort of something going on, wasn't there? You had all there was Rodney Marsh, Bobby Moore, all of that time. You suddenly had
Alan Mullery. Yeah, absolutely. There was this sort of strange sort of old people's home of a football club that. And actually, it was a period. It was one of the, until 2008-9 when it started again under Mohammed Al-Fayed. It was the period of history where we had an element of success in the 70s, and getting to the cup final was manifestly that. But yeah, no, it wasn't. And I just wish there was a more compelling reason other than at a loose end after university, I started going to Craven Cottage and fell in with a bunch of dedicated fans. One of the people I go with has not missed a game, you know, pre-COVID, hadn't missed a game in over 8 years, all that sort of thing. They're a pretty hardcore bunch. And it's meant for a huge amount of fun going home and away with them when I was younger, and still obviously trying to get there as much as possible. The one thing is both my two sons were born in St. George's in Tooting. So they are geographically predisposed towards them.
So they're proper now. They're bona fide.
Yeah, they're proper. Although they now live in the West Country, so they have to explain to everyone why they're Fulham fans in the West Country. I think it's probably the best bit of parenting I've done, however.
There is something about, before we move on from Fulham, but it's interesting how you mentioned Al-Fayed, and now you've got Shad Khan now. They are an attractive club to billionaires or to rich people who see potential in them. And we're in this period where American money or lots of investment money is looking at football clubs and trying to turn them into something else. You can see why Fulham is attractive in that sense, just the location and the proximity to the big time.
I was going to say, I think there's proximity. That's a really good word for it. Yeah. Not that we're talking about that club just down the road as well. I do think it's very notable also that there's just, I love being a fan of the club. It's not a great time to be a fan of the club today when we're speaking, which is the day after the end of the season. But it is a club that seems to have a sort of ethos about it. that it is welcoming. It's quite an inclusive club. We are genuinely interested in, as you say, down by the river, the where the ground is, it matters hugely. The sort of, but the proximity to being one of the big clubs is quite an interesting way of looking at it, because we're so close to a number of the London clubs, obviously Chelsea just down the road. And yet we've been, obviously in my time, losing away at Torquay and moving to 91st in the division when Torquay were 92nd under Ian Bramford back in the early 90s, to the period where, yes, we're playing in the Europa League final and we're finishing in the top seven of the Premier League and assuming that we're a Premiership club. But maybe that's one of the reasons why the combination of the London location and that sort of sense of nearness to the big clubs is one of the reasons why it's attractive to investment.
The Super League has come and gone recently. What was your view on that?
It was Sport England wise. I didn't have to have a professional view, but I had a personal view that chimed with a good deal of people's instinct, which was it just seemed like a very craven move to me. I hope people understand what I mean by saying that.
No pun intended, obviously.
Yeah, no, exactly. But a really sense of that sense that there was something there that everyone would get in behind rather than actually really understanding the environment in which these clubs operate. And it seemed to me very much that it reinforced, along with the return of fans now, just how important actually that fan engagement is, as you really did reinforce it to me. I understood in a purely business context how various people, whoever they are, the owners or their advisors, looking globally, thinking, actually, there's a whole potential audience out there for us. I'm sure this will work. And completely underestimating actually what fan engagement means and the attachment that fans have. And I feel quite proudly to the sense of being a legacy fan as being quite a good thing, actually, and feeling positive about that. But I think for my what it's led to is also very interesting, which is my interest from a professional basis is in good governance. So I am at Sport England, one of the two organisations that across publicly funded bodies is responsible for the Code for Sports Governance. We're obviously involved in supporting through that the DCMS and Tracy Crouch's fan-led review. Mm-hmm. I'm obviously very consciously aware that at grassroots and community sport, Sport England has a responsibility around the way that organisations, clubs, leagues run themselves and making sure they're safe, making sure they're inclusive, making sure they're accessible. And you don't actually have to stretch too far then to the governance of sport at that level. It's still about the principles of good governance, in my view, being well run, well governed, thoughtful about the people you're seeking to involve. And I think the Super League may have come and gone as a thing, but I think its impact is perhaps going to be one that enables a better look at the governance of sport generally. And it'll be through the football's lens, A, because it was football, the Super League, but B, football tends to take on the sort of first mover in sport, doesn't it? Where football goes, other sports they follow off.
It makes us what can be quite a dry sort of business type conversation, and it takes it into a whole new audience, doesn't it? And it's interesting, the fan engagement thing, because obviously you get a lot of people on here talking about fan engagement. And if you're not careful, when seen through a data lens, fan engagement becomes a sort of abstract idea in terms of it's a spreadsheet thing, and you're looking at scraping Twitter models, and you can do enormously clever things, but actually it seemed to me at the time, and you just articulated it really well, that fan engagement, it was quite revealing what they thought of fans and how they thought fans could be manipulated and you know, incentivized, and they're just the blithe assumption that they would go along with it. It's quite an interesting moment, I thought.
Yes, and I think it's combined with the return of crowds as well in a funny sort of way, because we've seen also how the football itself on the television, while it was wonderful when it first, the fact that it was put on behind closed doors in such a way was a monumental feat of everyone involved. But I watched the cup final and felt massively more engaged as a result of, in teams that I don't care too much for, although I did quite clearly want one of them to win. But that sense that it gave again to the experience on television was different. And I think that, yes, as you say, the sort of data-led suggestion would be that actually a television audience is interested in the game and not the bigger experience. But I think the combining of the two, for me, haven't really thought it in any great detail, but the sort of reaction to the Super League and the sort of return of fans and the sort of visceral sense we got at the weekend, again, maybe not at Craven Cottage, in some of the grounds where the celebration and the excitement and the engagement and the way that the fans made a difference to the performance and the lift of the team, all of those things have started to come together. That sense that you could just put the product on and it will be sufficient. And I think that's true. Again, I'm trying to learn the lessons of that for where we spend most of our time, which is thinking about within our communities, what role does sport play? And there's definitely an overlap. At the elite end, it's very much about how you engage, what it means to you in your life, the way that clubs, I often say to people, one of the differences between our focus on sport and our focus on physical activity, which is a very important part of our agenda in terms of a nation, you know, that moves and gets the benefit of that in their everyday life. But you don't get millions of people every weekend donning scarves and going watching people go for a run. There is something about the role that organized sport plays in our community that is applicable to the conversation we're having about the role of fans at an elite level, that sense of engagement and what it means and how we can maximise it for common good rather than individual good.
Sport England is a really interesting place, isn't it? Between sort of government and where the money goes. And so a lot of it is to do with incentives, I always think, in terms of how you change behaviours, both individuals, people like me, getting me moving, whatever shape or form that might be. In terms of organisations, what have you learnt or what do you know about how NGBs or how to incentivize organizations? Because that's the bit that I can never quite understand.
I think we're learning, and we've published a strategy document in January called Uniting the Movement, which probably felt more at times like almost like a manifesto than a strategy to me, and I'm very proud of the content of it. What we're learning, I think, is a couple of things. Which one is definitely that we need to unite around a more common purpose, the purpose of what we are all involved in being made more clear. I think historically, as you said, the sort of investment into individual organizations for individual purposes was very transactional, actually, and consequently didn't really manage to join the dots in a way that actually changing behavior across the country we need to do. One of the things this strategy has very much at its heart is a sense of purpose. What is the point of a more active nation? Why does it matter? What are the benefits that will come from that? And how, therefore, can we act in a way that can drive those? And I think uniting around that common purpose, which is essentially that when we move more, we're stronger. When we are actually active in our lives, we are physically, potentially the health and well-being of the nation can be positively impacted in that way. Certainly our mental health and our well-being. Certainly that sense of personal individual agency that you can have in your life. If you've got something that either you're good at or that you enjoy or that you find compelling, it definitely adds to our own sense of self, the connection that it creates. And we could probably talk about this more. I'm very interested in the role right now, in the role that we can play in sort of social cohesion and connecting communities, the role that sport can play, and actually just looking at that in the round. So when you look at it in those ways, I think we've learned and are learning that a sense of common purpose is actually fundamental, and it's not a given. Actually, sport has gone off in lots of different directions historically. Mm. And actually, is there something that we can find that is more binding? And is it that belief that if we make it available to everyone in a way that makes sense for them? I sometimes have tried to summarize it as three P's, which work for me, which is purpose, people, and place. Really, our job is to give people a sense of purpose as to why being active, playing sport, is right for them. Then provide people that can make it safe, inclusive, enjoyable, fun, and accessible, which is either leadership or coaches or administrators or volunteers, the way that people see their role. And then do it in a place that makes sense for people. Is it actually available to them, you know, locally? Is it affordable? Is it one that actually is genuinely accessible, both socially as well as physically? Probably social accessibility is the biggest hurdle we have to overcome in community and grassroots sport. Mm. Historically, clubs have been organised around the few, not the many, and with very great exceptions, of course, but there's that sense of exclusion being part of a sports club. So I think if we get purpose, people, and place, we've got a really powerful tool for benefiting society as a whole. And then the second bit, as I mentioned about the sort of transactional history of Sport England and other bodies like Sport England, is it becomes a very mechanistic answer to the quite a complex problem, which sounds like a podcasty thing to say. You do definitely look at it and you say, well, this is the problem. We'll invest in this program with this organization. And somehow after that, we expect the aggregation of that to fix it. And it never has. And I think what we've tried to turn the telescope around a bit and look at the problem a bit differently and say, actually, we need to be much more collaborative in our approach, that maybe our investment needs to be more about the capacity and the ability of organizations to deliver against a common purpose. And maybe our involvement too needs to be about corralling and advocating and campaigning, which is a very different role for Sport England, and still uses the money and uses the money as at its core. But I don't want to be seen as a grant giver or an investor. I want to be seen primarily as a body that is trying to set the direction of travel for the purpose that we're all involved in.
I've read it again this morning. I read it at the time when it came out, the report. And it's not, I don't think there's a word in it that I would disagree with, or I think that there is, no, I'm against that. And that leads to this question of what is it in terms of the limits of Sport England to do the work that, as you say, the purpose is there, but the purpose can get very broad. You can cover a lot of things. You're getting into physical health, but also into society or into where they do it. And my question is, what can't it do? Because if strategy is about saying no to things, which it is quite a lot of the time, what are you saying no to? What's outside of your remit?
I think, by the way, that's a perfectly legitimate reading of Uniting the Movement. If you to look at it and say it's a very permissive approach to trying to set an organization's direction. That was deliberate in the recognition that by doing that, we were actually seeking to corral around a common purpose. Yeah. So we need to be quite permissive to that point. I think the distinctions come in two critical areas. One is that where we can, we are looking more to align with the existing structures elsewhere, either within government or within public policy. So we are not by any means determined that in order to improve public health, we've somehow got to take on responsibility for public health. What our ambition is in Uniting the Movement is to align properly with, let me give you an example. In public health, one of the things that's emerging quite quickly now across a broad range and spectrum is the idea of social prescribing through primary healthcare professionals, with GPs or others. And the principle being that actually, rather than just automatically writing a prescription for a drug, that actually there's an opportunity for healthcare providers, GPs, to think about alternative opportunities where people can be engaged in their local community in an activity or some form of engagement that can support their treatment of the problem or the illness that they have. Physical activity, being active, is obviously a key element of that. Our job is properly then to align with that, the organizations that we fund and support, so that they can actually be effective. One of the challenges to social prescribing is the way that GPs historically have viewed the sort of marketplace out for them there. They don't actually either know what's available or they don't trust it. And actually that link and the role that the link workers play is a critical place for us to go. So we can be much more effective by engaging with, working in partnership with the organizations that are driving social prescribing than simply trying to just invest in every single relationship with every single GP. So I'm not necessarily explaining it too clearly, but that sense in the strategy of how you get by the choices is that you make the choice to be very much aligned with certain aspects of public policy that you think you can influence and change. The second one is the and you'll have seen it in the document, that the strategic choice in Uniting the Movement is the acknowledgement that we have essentially created a system that is very good at supporting the majority of the population, but has been historically quite exclusive of certain aspects of society, and that there are some very stubborn inequalities in the data that we collect and see, but in the experience and the evidence base of people in our communities as well. So we will make choices financially primarily based around organizations who can help us best deliver change in those areas. So we've been very clear in Uniting the Movement that while we understand that sport is, this is where you can get into something in a podcast, isn't it? So if you go into the health sector again and look at Professor Michael Marmot, who's been very influential, particularly in his reviews, 2-decade reviews that he's done in the health sector and the provision across the country,
He talks as a central tenet about proportionate universalism. That's his thing. And it sounds, you know, like we're getting off into theory, but it's actually intensely practical. His sense is that healthcare is a universal offer. There is no point structuring healthcare provision in a way that is not universal, because you immediately disadvantage a section of the population. Mm-hmm. But quite clearly, the need for it is not universal. It's disproportionate in certain communities, certain population areas and groups. So when you're looking at your investments, you are universal in your approach, but you're disproportionate where you focus your time and attention based on those groups. And we are applying the same principle to our investments. So we understand that some things in our sector are universal. We need to be supporting the bodies and the organizations, including governing bodies, to be in position to enable anyone to have the opportunity to take part in, at its most basic form, whether that's the provision of safeguarding, other standards, rules, competition, information for clubs, that sort of thing, universal provision. But we'll be disproportionate in thinking about groups that we want to engage. And the choices in the strategy will be made very clearly around where can we best impact on those inequalities that we're looking to cover.
If I go to my GP, is the GP, and I'm not being facetious here, but is the GP saying, okay, as part of your lifestyle, you should be, and sport of some short sport will be on that list of remedies?
That's the principle of what social prescribing is seeking to deliver, that actually there is a network of, first of all, so we've invested quite heavily actually in the short term with Public Health England in providing the materials and the education to GPs that they can understand the principle more. There's a program we run called Moving Medicine, which is precisely that, seeking to create more understanding and awareness among GPs about the principle of social prescription in a sporting context. But actually, it's also a thing that the Department for Health is starting to fund in a much more significant way. And of course, that's where the resources to actually affect change, not with us by any means, where they're funding the infrastructure that social prescribing requires, which is for within GP practices, you'll then get a link worker who's attached to them, who can then have an understanding of what's available in a local area. Right. And so the GP would say, I think you should actually think about being more physically active in terms of your, it isn't only in sport, it's very clearly one that's also identified, for example, towards art or social group. Examples I've seen and given in areas when I've been on visits pre-COVID, something for older people, it could be tea groups or knitting groups or things, you know, something in social, it's social prescribing, in other words, but sport can be a key part of it. We want sport to be a key part of it. And I think that's an example for me of where alignment with a much bigger picture can demonstrably drive two things. One, obviously, the supply side of that is that you need the local clubs to be safe, run, engaged in their local communities, and making their offer one that people are interested in taking up. So that's the job of the sport, that's the job of the governing body, that's the job of the clubs locally with our support. But actually, it's also definitely about the realization that being more physically active through playing a sport in your local community, through being engaged in a running club or going and taking part in a walking group, potentially as a starting point, that can actually have a profound impact on your health. But it's not Sport England's job to create a healthier nation through social prescribing. It's our job to align with social prescribing what sport and physical activity can bring.
Earlier, you said it's quite a mechanistic process, so it can be. It becomes you're an awarding body to various governing bodies. And quite often, and we had Nick Patel on earlier in the year, and Nick Coward made the point that he doesn't like seeing sport as verticals, and actually a different framing of it would be helpful. In the report, you make a nice statement about applying innovation and digital. And obviously, people who are listening to this podcast, a lot of them are in that world. And I'm wondering how you do that, because traditionally the criticism of governing bodies has been that they are not innovative, or they don't move unless they have to, and that public money breeds a complacency within the leadership and the executive of governing bodies. Now, that's an extreme framing of it, but that's the way in which people sometimes look at public sector sport. How do you go about encouraging innovation? How can you incentivize it, given that you're giving them money?
Something you said a little while ago is how do you work out what that means? I think that's one of the tasks we've set ourselves by publishing a decade-long strategy, actually, is that there's a bit of acknowledgement in that area, exactly in the way that you just framed it, Richard, which is how important it is, that sense. If you start, and I'm very conscious that compared to so many, including many who'll be listening in, hopefully, to this podcast, this is not an area that I've spent a huge amount of time in my own personal career and life. But understanding that what we still have fundamentally is a rather analog approach to the digital age when it comes to sport. You can manifest that very quickly if you look at the evidence base that it's a good deal more straightforward booking a takeaway or a flight than it is a squash court online, for example. Just that whole lack of underpinning data provision to enable people to find it much more flexible and easy than it is currently. What I think we mean, well, I know what we mean in terms of our own approach, is that we are going to incentivize innovation in a couple of ways. We're definitely going to incentivize it, as you say, through the way that we invest, because we're going to enable organizations. There'll be funds available, the traditional model, if you like, still quite transactional, but there'll be funds available for people to look at ways they can work differently, the ways that they can innovate around their own platforms, the way that they can innovate around looking at the way the game is played and the rules that they have currently in place versus how it might develop in the future. But I think also we've got to make sure that we don't try and own the sense that this is what innovation is in sport. There are a lot of, there's a very good case for saying that this is about trying to make the case for a greater level of understanding, as you said, trying to get away from, through our investment, getting away from that sense of dependency on the public sector breeding caution. Actually, maybe our resources can be used to breed innovation and actually push organizations in that direction. So a lot of it will be, in the first instance, about creating the space for people to feel they can have the confidence to think differently about what they need. And we are involved in certain areas of this now that I think will be quite powerful if we get it right. We've got a great desire to work more closely with the Open Data Institute, for example, and actually properly look at the way that sport can open up its data at community level and grassroots, where it's actually very often not particularly proprietorial when it comes down to the information, you know, contained. And actually, can we create a single platform for that sort of level of access that could really open up, whether it's leisure centres, whether it's clubs, whether it's other organisations? Because I think it's not just the governing bodies. It's hugely about the providers of sport in our community across the piece. And a big piece of that is the public sector in leisure and local authorities, and the way that the owner-operators of the gyms and pools and the sports halls that we have up and down the country are going to be a critical part of that as well. So I think we're still trying to work out, we have a very strong sense of why it matters. We're not absolutely yet in a position to say what it means. And I think that's quite exciting, because we've set that as the journey of the decade that we've set the strategy for, with a realization that it has to shift and it has to change.
It's quite alluring, the data thing. I talked to Robert Sullivan on here, and we've talked about the FA in terms of, I think they're on their third sort of digital data model system. So quite often the conversation moves to a system, you need a product of some sort. And then you've got innovation in the guise of Park Run. It's an obvious example.
Yes.
So Park Run is a brilliant piece of innovation. And I guess the question, which I always ask here, is whether that could have emerged from a governing body, or it's just culturally, it was always going to be come from the outside, which I'm wondering what the lessons of Park Run are for Sport England.
Yeah, no, huge. And one of the things there that I think we could pick up, whether or not it could, the fact that it didn't should be a compelling reason why we should be relaxed about the way in which ideas, where ideas come from, and certainly not feel automatically that there has to be some sort of proprietorial element to it in the sort of traditional models. I think increasingly governing bodies are comfortable with that, actually. I might be, you talk to the individuals concerned, they might say something slightly different. But I think that the attempts now, perhaps retrofitting positive relationships onto Park Run with the governing bodies, but that's happening. And the sort of linkage increasingly between the innovation that Park Run has shown. Park Run's also, yeah, a brilliant example, because it also absolutely understood place as a really good example of a sport offer, an activity offer that understands place. People do it where they do it because they feel connected to that place totally, and they volunteer and they make that. There's no prescription. It's a brilliant model, therefore, for understanding people and place. And I think that that sort of innovation, we have to be more open to. It's when I talked about some of the funds and some of the engagement that we can put together in the, we're forming our view now on how we're going to implement the first stages of uniting the movement, but being open to those sorts of groups. If I give you a slightly different example, thinking about the long-standing challenge of teenage girls, particularly the drop-off in activity levels at school. Mm-hmm. So we've a partnership, it's a sizable investment in an organization called Studio U, which is a sort of Netflix-style platform for not only the PE teachers and those involved in provision, but also the young people themselves to go on and actually find stuff and information and tools and examples and case studies of ways that actually young girls have said they want to be engaged and turning it around, basically. Now, that's important because that is a platform that those of us that grew up through historical sports structures would think, oh, that's all a bit gimmicky or that's something that won't necessarily work. But it's proving to be really successful because it's actually gone to this girl can has that as a principle, mm-hmm. as a major campaign that we hold. That idea that you actually start with what the end user's problems have been historically and shift and change around those rather than try and bring them into the tent of what we're already familiar with. And I think that's what we mean by innovation, whether it's finding ways. I would hope that if another example of a park run emerges, our sort of cultural approach to our investment at community level would be a lot more amenable to giving it an opportunity. I think it's probably fair to say if you talk to those involved in Park Run, that wasn't necessarily the case with Sport England when it was first starting up, but we're heavily involved in supporting them now for the very good reason that they're incredibly effective in getting people active.
The challenge with it, and this is not just a Sport England challenge, but any publicly funded body, innovation is a question of risk as well, isn't it? So it's quite hard for public money to be risked in the same way. You know what I mean? The tropes of Silicon Valley and the digital era have been fail fast, test and learn, coming with an assumption that some money will be wasted along the way. And then it's hard for Sport England to say, okay, now we're gonna throw some things on the wall and see whatever cliche we use to try and work out what works and whether or not, and because you're a headline away from, well, they've wasted this money on that. They were into picking winners, the sort of industrial strategy problems of all governments. And that's a, I don't see a route through that. It's just, I suppose you have to risk, you live with that, do you?
I particularly, if I may get my own tiny violin out for a moment, I live with that particularly as the chief executive because I hold the role of accountable officer and consequently I'm accountable to Parliament under managing public money, which is the Treasury document, which if you read, you know, chapter 3 of managing public money, you'd probably not really want to get out of bed in the morning. Innovate. I take that extremely seriously. And the COVID response is probably the best example for us about how we've realized that our attitude to risk though has to shift if we're actually going to make a difference in this in terms of change. And therefore we have to make sure that we have effective public control. It's still a frustration, I know, for many organizations, the level of diligence or the level of what they would describe as bureaucracy around the funding from Sport England. But there has to be effective public control. You're absolutely right. It could be a headline or it could be a public accounts committee. But one way or the other, there'd be some scrutiny of our decision making where it's taxpayers' money or it's lottery funding. There is such a debate about where that money should go that really you want to maximize every pound. I think we have to be incredibly clear that we have a knowledge of where our money is going and why, and that we're confident that it's evidence as to why that's an effective use of that money. But we're not prescriptive about necessarily what the outcome of that investment is going to deliver. Otherwise, we'd never advance beyond, we'd always be looking at last year's investment rather than next year's investment in that sense. We're working that through. It's fascinating you've asked me about that because it's consequential at the moment to how we're setting up the underpinning investment strategy to uniting the movement. What's our attitude to risk? It sounds very dry, but it's in the Sport England context, that nexus, as you say, between government and a sector. When you want to strategically invest, when you want to do it in a way that is driving an agenda, but you're also very conscious that it's public money, how do you make sure that those two things align? And part of that's about capital P politics. It's about how you engage. It's about how you present. It's about how you report. And part of it's very much about lower P politics, which is about how you collaborate and get everyone on the same page in terms of the purpose and the mission of the investment. And I think we're getting better at that. And I think many sports councils, and I can look across at my colleagues in the Arts Council and see exactly the same thing going on there, where they're trying to find the balance between innovation that can genuinely stimulate out of COVID, particularly can stimulate the change and the requirements that are needed, but do that in a way where you're still able to demonstrate why the money's been spent in the way that it has. And it will always be a balance, and it's a daily balance, but we're getting better at it, I think. And I also think, again, if you look at, for example, our response to our community emergency fund, when we put £35 million out very early on when COVID struck, to basically say to the local fabric of the sports clubs and community groups, we are not going to be overly interrogating of the precise areas of spend here. We just need enough evidence from you that A, you qualify, because not every sports club would qualify, B, that it's going into a reputable bank account, that we can actually show that it's going into the organization that we're giving the money to, and that there is an outline view of why the money is needed now and what the purpose of the spend would be. And it was genuinely liberating, because obviously none of it, the quantum was huge, but the individual investments were quite small. So you have to take a risk-based approach to the individual investments. But I think it did teach us that the opposite there would have not to have reacted quickly and put a sort of fail-safe into place, by which time many of those organizations may not have survived the lockdown. Just one other quick thing that we're trying to do differently in that respect is a partner fund to that, or a sort of sister fund to that, was what we very explicitly called our Tackling Inequalities Fund, to go back to what we talked about earlier about where disproportionately we're focused. And I think there's something in there in answering your question, which is we're investing through, so far that fund's invested into about nearly 4,000. I think it's going to get up to about 5,000 community bodies on the ground who are specifically involved in communities who have been disproportionately impacted by COVID. But we've done that through 70 partners. So we've worked actually through our partners who we have a close relationship with, have a funding agreement with, we have all the controls in place. And we've essentially worked with them to understand the audiences and then trust them to engage the right clubs more than we would ever have previously done. That's led to, under the Tackling Inequalities Fund, it's a £20 million fund. It's a lot of money. Over 80% of the recipients had never received public funding before. So we're reaching audiences who've previously never really been able to engage. So there's something in this about the balance between the nature of being a public body, the accountability that brings. I was in front of the select committee last week. Mm-hmm. You never lose that sense of public accountability, but you can find ways to innovate and find ways to invest where you can reach new audiences.
I used to teach in the public sector. This is donkeys years ago. And I come to these questions with probably that baggage. And I noticed in the 10-year plan, the focus on coaches, that was interesting. And I thought, because when we were, this is staff room moaning, but whenever we did get any money, it would always go on buildings and computer rooms, and because it was an easily demonstrable, this is progress is taking place, and the head would go around and say, and go and point at these shiny new rooms, rather than people, because people are a pain in the ass and they wouldn't, sometimes don't do what you don't want them to do, etc. How do you make that balance? Because I know obviously you need both in an ideal world, but how do you go about making the argument for coaches and for people rather than buildings?
I think because, back to purpose, people and place, unless you are creating environments in those buildings that are genuinely people want to engage in, which is the role of the volunteer, the coach, the instructor, whoever it is in the workforce, or it's the leader of the bodies that are running the things at a national level, unless we're genuinely focused on the people in sport, I don't think we're ever going to shift the dial that we're desperate to shift, which is the one where people feel included and feel it's engaged and feel it's for them. And I think there's a huge amount of lessons there too within, I mean, we're not formally responsible for school sport, but I think the way in which school sport is provided both at primary and secondary level, and the focus, if you understand and believe in physical literacy, the most important element of a young person's physical literacy is that they enjoy it. Actually, it's not that they have the ability to play a delightful backhand or you know, whatever it is. It's actually that they enjoy it. They have fun. And I think once that's embedded in the concept of actually, for a lot of people, it has been off-putting. And yet we've always focused as the industry on what makes it right for us and the people that are involved. And I think that people can change that. Buildings can't change that. And also, I think if you go on to place and thinking about places where activity happens, it's changing, it's shifting. People have a very different relationship now with their ability to engage. It's much more informal often. It's often going to be much more in tune with their working life or their family life. The idea that you would, football is a good example. Still, the 11-a-side affiliated game on a grass pitch is a critical part of the mix. Mm. But actually, the growth in football is in informal games and in small-sided games and in some of the, you know, artificial pitches that have been put up in urban spaces. And so you think differently straight away about the facility, but you also particularly need to think about the people. So our strategic intent is, you're right, to pick up on coaches, but it's more than that. It's actually just understanding that we need to have safe, well-run, inclusive, accessible, fun environments for people to be active. And that's a people-led thing. Therefore, our investment in, so we're investing heavily in the professional end, in the organization with the acronym that very few people can spell out, but CIMSPA, the Chartered Institute of Management for Sport and Physical Activity.
That needs a bit of marketing, but, you know, doesn't it? That acronym.
I know, yeah. but CIMSPA's a very important organisation in terms of our partnership with them, alongside UK Coaching and other bodies, because what CIMSPA is starting to do is to think about the level of, for want of a better word, accreditation that we can have that is consistent across the sector, whereas it's been very sport-specific. It's going back to that horizontal rather than vertical approach. One of the things that I would like to see in the next 5 years is a shift away from coaching qualification being primarily about the technical skill of the coach and much more about the universal skill of the coach. Are they able to? How are they in terms of their approach? This is at community level particularly. But how are they in relation to their understanding of accessibility, both in literal physical terms and more importantly in how welcoming the environment is? Actually, is it a safe environment? Have we got a common, consistent accreditation across safeguarding and well-being, and making it fun, making it inclusive? We've invested quite heavily in schools in supporting the DfE on secondary school level PE training, just to enable PE teachers to understand and increase their school with their toolbox around making sport inclusive, because actually they're not taught that when they go to teach training college. Yeah. They're taught how to make it specialist.
There's also a sort of emotional intelligence bit to the job, which again is the bit that is really hard to measure and to train and to do anything about. So it doesn't get measured and trained, because that's how it works.
And so what we're hoping to do is actually the measure of purpose in the end is going to be, we're still interested in numbers. We still care about the numbers of people doing things, and we still care about that number going up. But actually, we're very much more motivated by the purpose of it all and why people are engaged. And you need, whether it's professional coaches, whether it's the one of the things that we've literally just announced is a 5 million package into helping the workforce that's really had to sit on its hands for the best part of a year, the PTs and the instructors in gyms and pools, to retrain, to basically enable them, hopefully as we open up more fully after June the 21st or whenever it is, to be in a position where they've actually refreshed some of the core skills that they require to be able to do the job. And I think that's a really important intervention, because I don't think I think we take too much that for granted, and we think coaching is all about the ability to teach a 9-year-old a forward defence, when actually it should be about making that 9-year-old fall in love with cricket.
Absolutely. I've got one last thing. I'm a bit over gold medals as a thing. And I know this is not in Sport England's remit, but it, obviously the inspiration story is all about the place. And we're sports marketing, and a lot of people listening to this will be from sports marketing. And I don't know why. I do know. I think it feels a bit immature for a nation to be. They're so expensive, gold medals. I'm not sure the inspiration story. I think it's too simple. And I think it's telling the wrong story. What do you think about gold medals?
Bring that one up with only a few minutes left. Why don't, having full disclosure, my entry into sport as a very, you know, unsuccessful sports person myself was in 2004 when I got a job at UK Sport. So I worked at UK Sport through to in that period when the no compromise principle was embedded. Sue Campbell, Liz Nicol, Peter Keane, John Steele, the team at UK Sport leading up to London 2012. So I have a perspective that's formed through that. And then I had 8 years as the chief executive of the British Paralympic Association, where the games profile was about our medal success in terms of Paralympics GB athletes. I think I have a fairly clear view. I am not over gold medals or medals, but I am over the idea that they are inspirational to individuals. I don't think they are at all. I think they're a measure of a couple of things. I think they're a measure of our national pride and identity. It was actually Peter Keane, who many people on this podcast will hopefully have heard of, who said to me in passing, it's the sort of way Pete speaks, that Team GB and Paralympics GB are almost the final positive manifestation of Britishness. We don't have many ways other than going to war these days when we're Great Britain.
True.
And actually that sense of national identity and pride, whether that's whether I'm speaking here as somebody who's not paying enough attention to some of the arguments going on right now about the union, but from a sporting point of view, our collective success measured through our success at the games, I think still matters. Because I also think it drives, we've seen manifestly, it drives systemic behavior. And that can be a hugely positive thing, as well as, unfortunately, at times having manifested itself as quite a negative. We've got a hugely driven, a lot of the infrastructure around sport has been driven by our desire to succeed at elite level. Some of the ways that we've developed coaching, some of the ways that we've developed performance management, some of the ways that we've developed technology has been really driven by that desire to see success. I also think it helps in particular terms governing bodies. If you take netball, for example, which is a hugely, I think, a very good model for how a governing body has used success at the elite level to create both the resources and the capacity, but also the interest to then drive the game at grassroots, whether it's through the Vitality Partnership for the Roses or whether it was through just the visual representation of women for women and girls, that it's actually a game that they can re-engage with and enjoy. I think there are good examples where there is a positive relationship to success. And the gold medal in the Commonwealth Games was a key part of that. It would not have that profile without that gold medal if the team was finishing in the quarterfinals and getting knocked out. So I don't think we should abandon it. What we should abandon is this idea that because you see Jess Unis on a Saturday win a gold medal, you're out there yourself on a Monday. I don't think that's proven. I think it's unhelpful, actually. The only other final thing for me, it was very important in a Paralympic context.
I'm just completely contradicting my own point, but where I do I am really pro the Paralympic gold medal table, because I think it tells us something. Well, I like to think it reflects really well on Britain,
that we take it very seriously and we care. Yes, and I think you're right. I also think that disproportionately success at the Paralympic Games gives status and profile and visibility to those athletes, and then consequently to disabled sport, and then consequently actually the true message and the true power of the Paralympics. And we can have a whole other podcast around that, which is not sport, actually. It's about your individual relationship with what's possible and your understanding that your perceptions of what's possible are deeply challenged when you actually watch disability sport at the highest level, because it's there in front of you on a minute by minute basis through the games of people actually demonstrating that what you possibly thought was not possible is. And that's not about reaching the same level. That's the joy of it. So I could never ride my bike as fast as Chris Hoy. So there's no point trying to aspire to that. Quite patently, that's true. But I can watch Jodie Cundy or some of the other cyclists, or watch, is Johnny Peacock running 100 meters in 10 and a half seconds when he's got an leg amputated above the knee? What does that tell me? It doesn't tell me that I have to run it in 10 and a half seconds. It just tells me that actually perceptions of what a disabled person might not be able to do are really quite ill-informed if you then understand what's possible through that. And Johnny going on Strictly was probably just as important, and he wouldn't have got on Strictly without the gold medal. So in a nutshell, it's about getting disabled people on Strictly Come Dancing. That's why it matters.
That's your job.
Yeah.
That should be in the strategy document. Listen,
exactly.
Tim, thanks very much for your time. I really enjoyed that. What's your week of activity? What do you do?
I have been under lockdown very early on. I bought myself a rowing machine that is just about staying together. It's not a top end one by any means. I'm quite religious about that in the morning before, because they are quite long days, and I've got with my sons as well, their lives and everything. But so I do that in the morning together with a bit of routine. We walk the dog at some point in the day, usually at the end of the day, and then I try and get out on my bike when I can. But it's an organized sport. I volunteered. My children play football and row, and that I tend to try and go and help out there rather more than get involved myself.
Sounds like you're fitting the job into the staying active
thing. I've overemphasized for this podcast on the basis that I felt I should.
Yeah, right. Listen, thanks very much for your time. Really enjoyed that.
Thank you. Likewise. Thank you, Richard.